Welcome to episode 12 of our Planet Earth series. Now, these programs are a mix of factual reports and sometimes poetry and sometimes music, all of them about our home planet.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling home.
I had hoped this evening that I could announce that Australia now has another satellite in orbit. The nanosatellite Centauri 4 was to be lofted from Cape Canaveral by a Falcon 9 rocket on Saturday morning. Then, on Friday, it was announced the mission would be delayed to allow more time to check out the 88 satellites on board. Before 5 a.m. Australian Eastern Time this morning, another attempt was made to launch. Here is a time-edited version of the commentary from SpaceX, the company that manufactures and refurbishes the Falcon 9 launch vehicles.
Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, June 29th, and we're here at SpaceX's headquarters in Hawthorne, California. You're looking at a live view of Falcon 9 as it awaits its 2:56 p.m. Eastern Time launch from Space Launch Complex 40 at Cape Canaveral Space Force Station in Florida. My name is Andy Tran, and I'm a production supervisor here at SpaceX. Welcome to the webcast for SpaceX's Transfer 2 mission. It's our second dedicated SmallSat Rideshare program launch and our 20th launch of 2021. SpaceX created this program to provide small satellite operators with more flight opportunities and flexible flight times at a competitive price. There are 85 spacecraft on board in addition to three Starlink satellites. This includes CubeSats, Microsats, and orbital transfer vehicles, sometimes called space tugs, which would deploy their spacecraft after separating from Falcon 9. Today's mission is the eighth flight for this particular booster. It debuted about a year ago on the GPS-3 Space Vehicle No. 3 mission, and it also supported the TurkSat-5A mission as well as five Starlink missions. The bottom two-thirds of the vehicle is the first stage. Its objective is to accelerate the vehicle through the Earth's atmosphere to space and then separate from the rest of the rocket. From there, it will make its way back to Earth and target a landing back on land this afternoon on Landing Zone 1, which is the pad that you see on screen right now. On top of the first stage is the black carbon fiber interstage. It connects the two stages and houses the pneumatic pushers that allow the first and second stage to separate during flight. Then on top of the inner stage is the Falcon 9 second stage, which takes the payload to its eventual destination in orbit. After the first stage separates about 2.5 minutes into flight, the second stage will then carry the 88 spacecraft to orbit. In order to get to the intended orbit today, we'll need to light our second stage twice before deploying all of our payloads. And at the very top of the rocket, the satellites are safely enclosed inside of the 17-foot diameter payload's fairing. This protects the payload from aerothermal loads, heating, and contamination during ascent. Once we reach the vacuum of space, we will jettison the fairing as the second stage continues its journey to orbit. For today's mission, our fairing is making its third flight, and we will be attempting to recover the fairing halves from the water following landing on our chartered recovery vessel, HOS Briarwood. And the vehicle is a bipropellant vehicle, which means that it uses two types of propellants. For fuel, a refined form of kerosene called RP1, and for its oxidizer, superchilled liquid oxygen, also known as LOX. And just to check quick in on weather, we're still green. The range is standing by to support today's mission. As a reminder, if we don't launch today, we do have a backup opportunity tomorrow at the same time.
Stage 2 LOX load complete.
And there was a call up for second stage LOX loading complete. That is the last of propellant load. Falcon 9 is now fully fueled and ready to lift off in about a minute and 40 seconds. This is the eighth time that this booster will be flying today. And a bit later on to mission, we'll also be attempting to recover it for the eighth time back at Landing Zone 1.
Flight computers in startup.
So we have some excitement here in Hawthorne, but
continuous Falcon 9 is no good. We'll hold at 30 seconds of range. Status has not changed.
Falcon 9 is in startup, and this means that the first and second stages are beginning to pressurize for launch. So we're just about 20 seconds away from liftoff.
LD, this is RCN. Countdown range is no-go. Repeat, range is no-go.
Hold, hold, hold.
And we did hear the call to hold. Give us a second. We're going to check in with the teams and see if we can get some more information for you.
The countdown hold due to a failed range.
So we did have a hold. It looks like the range was a no-go. There might have been an airplane in the area. We do have a backup opportunity tomorrow, but for today, that's going to do it for us. Hopefully, you'll join us tomorrow for the next launch attempt of Transporter 2.
The countdown got to T-minus 11 seconds before the clock was stopped. The Australian Centauri 4 satellite was one of the 88 satellites enclosed in the payload fairing atop that Falcon 9 rocket. The shoebox-sized satellite will circle the globe at an altitude of 450 kilometres. It was made in Adelaide by Fleet Space. This company aims to use satellites for the Internet of Things. Centauri 4 is the most advanced payload Fleet has made. The satellite uses radio digital beamforming technology invented by Fleet Space. Here's a description of that technology.
Space is no longer the sole domain of governments and multi-billion dollar satellites. Space is open for business. And we are only just starting to tap into what is possible. Our industry-leading innovations take the best of tech and adapt it for the challenges and opportunities in our growing fleet of nanosatellites. Our brilliant team's work on integrating beamforming is just one example we are excited to share.
With a crowded radio spectrum containing all the world's wireless communications, bandwidth efficiency is everything. Radio signals can be mechanically steered through the shape and direction of an antenna. Beamforming allows an array of antennas to digitally steer the signal by manipulating the phase and amplitude. The steerable pattern combines to boost or nullify the signal in certain directions. With beamforming, we increase the throughput of customer data, service a higher number of portals at once, and increase data reliability and security by reducing the impact of interference. But while beamforming on Earth is quite straightforward, trying to manage this in the vacuum of space on a tiny nanosat, not as easy.
We have very, very tight constraints. Limited power, battery size.
We reroute the signal processing algorithm to reduce its computational power, and we manage the battery depth of discharge when beamforming to extend its life.
Radiation in space can corrupt data, and temperature swings affect synchronization.
We run simultaneous code that verifies system integrity and also an internal calibration process which corrects synchronization errors across temperature gradients.
A small volume to fit everything in.
We 3D print our optimized antenna array and iteratively design our circuit boards to be able to fit it inside the nanosatellites,
radiating excess heat away.
We thermally isolate the beamform payload, and we use custom thermal straps to conduct heat away to the exterior walls.
And with everything close together, there is interference to protect from.
We do a lot of testing and redesign, and more testing.
Nanosats already dramatically reduce the cost barrier for getting into space, and by integrating beamforming with the unique methods we've developed, we can do more work, transfer more data, and do it in flexible, secure ways never before possible at this scale. The promise of satellites servicing the Internet of Things is not about smart refrigerators, but about collecting and organizing vast amounts of data from every remote corner of the Earth. From tracking power outages, renewable energy, and bushfire risk, to applications in defense, mining, and logistics, everything hinges on how efficient and reliable the satellite system is.
The future of space is open to disruption at every scale, and discovering new ways we can innovate in space, it's what drives us to do what we do every day.
Our Fleet Space claims their technology is world first. The bandwidth efficiency is becoming essential in a crowded radio spectrum. With the ability to shape and steer multiple beams in their nanosatellites, Fleet says there will be reduced interference. This will enable Fleet to perform more work, transfer more data, and do it in flexible and secure ways never before possible. Fleet aims to have its satellites collect and distribute vast amounts of data from every remote corner of the Earth. Customers will organize this data. For example, a critical infrastructure customer could track power outages, receive alerts of unwanted encroachments along easements, and access bushfire risks. There are also applications in defense, mining, and logistics. Now, Centauri 4 is Fleet Space's sixth satellite. And interestingly, 2 weeks ago, Fleet Space was announced by the Australian Space Agency as one of two recipients in round two of the federal government's Moon to Mars Supply Chain Capability Improvement Grant. Worth $386,000, the grant will enable Fleet to improve the capabilities of its agnostic hybrid satellite low-powered wide area network. It will also allow Fleet to expand on its already deployed solutions for South Australian power networks and for Oz Minerals. By the way, the other recipient of the Space Agency grants was Crystal Aid Manufacture. That company supplies electronic components to the international space industry. And we have more about Planet Earth coming up.
On FM, online, and on TuneIn, 24/7. This is 88.3 Southern FM.
Earth, below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless, calling. Calling home.
And we stay in South Australia. The state government there has committed $6.5 million to send a small, locally made satellite to low Earth orbit in 2022. Hey, that's next year, folks. Premier Stephen Marshall said that SASAT-1, as it is presently called, will deliver space-derived services to the state. It will help improve emergency services, water quality, mining and bushfire mitigation. The satellite project is being managed through the SmartSat Cooperative Research Centre, which the federal government launched with $55 million of funding in 2019. It will be built by the South Australian company Innovor Technologies and operated by the Adelaide company Mariota Global. The SASAT will operate until 2025. It is funded through the South Australian government's Economic Business Growth Fund. Now, the Premier's office has been kind enough to send me the recording of the opening announcement, and we're going to hear Stephen Marshall, the Premier, and Professor Andy Koronis, the Chief Executive of CRC SmartSats, and Alex Grant, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Mariota.
So the announcement today is that South Australia will be launching its own satellite, the first state in Australia, one of the first sub-national governments in the world to have its own satellite. We're super excited about this mission, which we're officially launching today. It is going to be built and then launched over the next 15 months, and then it will be providing data back to South Australia to inform government, to educate our next generation of entrants into the space sector, and to fill out and develop that space heritage that we need for our supply chain in South Australia. We'll be doing that over the subsequent 3 years. So hugely exciting. The state government is making a $5 million investment in this satellite. Most importantly, it's going to be built right here in Adelaide on Lot 14. We've selected to work with Innovor. As you would know, because you've probably seen Innovore before. This is a very advanced company in the space sector here in Australia. They've already got fantastic projects with the CSIRO and the Department of Defence. So this won't be their first project, but it will certainly be the first Australian satellite with a commercial application, which is going to be absolutely fantastic. And it will start to build out that space heritage that we so desperately need to grow the overall space offering in our state. We know that the federal government has got a huge ambition in terms of the space sector and the jobs that it will create over the next decade. We're going to cement our place as the natural home for the space sector for Australia right here in South Australia. I'm now going to pass over to Professor Andy Koronius. As you know, Andy Koronius is the Chief Executive of the Smart Satellite CRC, also based here on Lot 14. It's the largest space-related research program in the history of Australia, and he's going to tell us a little bit more, because it will be the Smart Satellite CRC who will be the ones who are delivering this project.
Thank you very much, Premier. SmartSat is delighted to be part of this groundbreaking initiative, we feel, and I think that the Premier and his government should be commended for the great leadership foresight for this visionary initiative that is promising not only to grow our industry, but also it promises to really enhance the lives of everyone in South Australia and beyond. We feel that we, the SmartSat CRC, is privileged to be leading this, along with our partners, Myriota, Innovo, and others, to really deliver a satellite the size of a cereal box. You may say, well, that doesn't seem as very kind of impactful, but actually it has the potential, with the technologies that we will be putting on the satellite, it has the potential to really be highly impactful, game-changing, in providing, not only providing the growth for the business, to allow our business to really grow and strengthen and actually supercharge the competitiveness of local businesses so that they can become global players, so that they can actually sell to the world instead of vice versa. We seem to have an addiction for importing high tech. We have a dependency on the supply chain, of global supply chain, and yet this current status of COVID-19 has brought into full view the type of problems that we have with global supply chains. So we want to be able to not only build for our own needs, but actually build for our companies, companies like Myriota and Innovo, to become global companies, to be able to deliver to the world, to create value, to bring it back here in South Australia, and therefore generate jobs. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Andy. You might ask whether Alex Grant can come forward, and then after Alex, who is from Myriota, there are hosts here this morning, we will hear from Matt Tetlow from Innovore. I would just like to congratulate Alex Grant and the team at Myriota. Last year they went out to raise capital. More than $30 million was brought in by Myriota, so that's investment coming from outside of the state, inside the state, to grow the size of our space sector. So congratulations to everybody at Myriota. Now we'll hear a little bit more about this mission from Alex Grant.
Here in the city, we're very fortunate to have almost ubiquitous connectivity. We don't have to go very far out into other parts of Australia, and that just completely disappears. In fact, cellular connectivity only covers about 30% of Australian geography. And if you look more broadly to the globe, ground-based communication systems like cellular only cover about 10% of the Earth's surface once we take into account maritime areas. So that's a real challenge to deliver the data that governments and industry need for increased productivity and to understand our environment when we have operations in those remote areas without communications. And this is really why Myriota was founded back in 2015. And in fact, to date, over a number of funding rounds, including the one that we closed last year, we brought in more than $50 million investment from Australian venture capital and international players like Boeing and Singtel. It's already been mentioned that in terms of space infrastructure, which we will use every day, you will have a satellite receiver right in your cell phone for positioning purposes. We are reliant on overseas built infrastructure to deliver those services. And the current pandemic has really highlighted the fragility of those global supply chains and the importance of having local domestic capability to deliver critical services. This satellite will be an Australian innovation addressing specific Australian challenges around water quality and water security, climate, weather, energy infrastructure and energy surety, resources, mining, and our vast maritime areas. So there's endless opportunities for innovation built on top of the data connectivity and the Earth imaging capability that this satellite will deliver. The satellite is also a first. It will be the first Australian-built satellite to offer commercial services, which sounds incredible, but is actually true, and is a world first to combine Internet of Things data connectivity together with Earth imaging from space. This really further advances South Australia as a leader in space technology. We already have companies like Innovore and like Myriota, but beyond our companies, there's a massive halo effect in terms of our supply chains, both upstream and downstream, in terms of things that will be launched into space, and then applications, sensors, software, analytics that make use of the IoT and Earth imaging data here on the ground that delivers benefit derived from space to people here on the ground. Not only will this deliver benefit to South Australia, to SA government and to industry in South Australia, there is a massive opportunity for export of those same services nationally and globally, and also for the export of key spacecraft technologies and spacecraft globally. So I'm going to stop there and perhaps hand over to my colleague.
Can I just ask you one question before you go?
Sure.
Is Myriota's role, do you mind just explaining in layman terms what Myriota's role will be in the satellite and the release of it?
Yes, so Myriota already has a track record in operating satellites and delivering Internet of Things data connectivity from satellites. So we have the ground-based infrastructure, operations team, and the connectivity technology to provide the IoT services. We will be operating the satellite, so we'll be procuring the satellite from Innovore, operating the satellite and delivering those IoT services and, new for Myriota, Earth observation services to various customers.
So data, the collection data. Of the data and the distribution of it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We will be the data service provider.
Thank you.
And a massive congratulations to Innovore. They have trebled the size of the number of people employed at their company over the last 2 years. This is just the start. We launched our space sector plan only late last year. We are moving ahead. We really want to cement ourselves as the centre of the space sector in Australia, and we know that this is one of the fastest growing sectors anywhere in the world at the moment. So huge opportunities for companies in South Australia and massive opportunities for students who want to learn more about space and the careers that they're going to get in space while they're at school.
Well, at the moment, most of the satellite space services that we get are all from overseas. This is the first commercially available service that will be able to actually have remote sensing, Earth observation capability, that we will own that data, that we will be able to control the path, the orbit of the satellite, and actually then use that data with other freely available data that are from overseas to fuse new applications that are very specific to South Australia and to Australia. So it will enable us, it will almost begin the journey, if you like, for us to develop our own capabilities. It will not be done just by only one single satellite, but from little acorns, big old trees grow.
We've been out working on our 9 growth strategies for South Australia. One of those areas, of course, is the space sector. So this opportunity really came up as part of the preliminary work that we did on the development of that space strategy. And we're just so grateful to be able to have the Smart Satellite CRC in South Australia with incredible capability right in this building, a couple of floors above us, I think. And so that's really given us the opportunity to be able to move very, very quickly with this exciting project. Just to answer one of Stacey's questions earlier, we've already had some preliminary discussions with Dr. Andrew Johnson, who's head of the Bureau of Australian Meteorology. There are so many applications, both here in Australia, but also overseas, in terms of satellite technology. We've gone basically from a very small number of very large satellites orbiting the Earth, the size of a bus, towards a constellation of very small satellites operating together in those constellations to give us that dark and low Earth orbit. And South Australia is really presenting itself now as one of the, you know, the critical areas of expertise in this new generation right around the world. What I can say is this. This project delivers on multiple levels. It's going to inspire the next generation of young people to move into this sector. It's going to deliver a breadth of projects to develop sovereign capability in the space sector. I mean, to be manufacturing satellites in the centre of our CBD is absolutely extraordinary. And also, obviously, the productivity improvements that are going to come for government and also the private sector. But also, I think that there is an opportunity to use this project for space diplomacy. So this can be our contribution to create links with the UK Space Bridge, with a range of other projects that operate in Canada, the US, the UK, and in fact, right around the world. There are many MOUs that the South Australian space industry has already signed, and this is our contribution. We have been, if you like, the receiver of lots of their technology here in the past, and now we want to contribute. Instance today, we're focused on getting our own satellite, SASAT-1, up into low Earth orbit and making sure that we can derive the benefits right here in our state. Look, we can look at enormous opportunities that exist in the space sector now and into the future. We've got 15 months of approximately until the launch of this satellite. And we'll look at every opportunity for being able to share that data with other people that are friends and have been sharing their data with us, but also looking for some commercial opportunities.
We are very excited about space in South Australia.
Yes, they're very excited about space in South Australia. And that recording was sent to the space show especially by the Office of the Premier of South Australia, Stephen Marshall. And interestingly, there's a naming competition which has been open to children in South Australia. So expect in the near future to hear a new name for SASAT-1.
88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless.
On last week's The Space Show, we were hearing about the Sentinel-6 satellite. And Craig Donlan, a mission scientist on the Sentinel-6, he works for the European Space Agency, was describing what it will do. So, he's looking at the Earth, we're measuring sea levels in particular. He was asked, why are things changing on our planet?
I mean, we have to look at why things are changing. And things are changing because we're kicking the Earth system. We've changed its dynamic equilibrium. And we've changed that by essentially, in geological timescales, at least more or less instantaneously burning as much carbon as we possibly can to fuel our societal development. And we're a very successful species. The population of our planet has grown immensely, and it has needs. You want to know what can be done. I mean, the example I can give here is we have to adapt. So we have to acknowledge that there is a commitment to global warming, and that commitment will take many centuries to work its way through. And therefore, adaptation to the inexorable rise now of sea level is an important step. And that can be done in different ways. We can use ecosystem developments. We can protect our shorelines. And we can even, at the worst case, we have to move people away from the coastlines to higher ground. We know that from recent work that 10 millimeters rise in sea level gives an additional exposure of 2 to 3 million more people. So there is a big, big impact coming here. Perhaps the other thing to think about is it's a political issue to make change. And the Montreal Protocol, which addressed CFCs a few decades ago now, has been shown to be very successful. I mean, political change can be brought around. I think the challenge to society today is more to think about your everyday lives. How can you reduce your carbon footprint? How can you help Earth actually manage the big changes that are taking place by reducing your impact and trying to work in a more sustainable manner together with Earth systems? And then we can approach something like the Montreal Protocol, and the Paris Agreement is a starting point for that, and it's something that we almost take quite seriously. So Montreal gives us a hope that things can be done, but it will demand personal change. It'll demand personal changes in the way you live your life and what you do. And that's something we have to all take on board as a society. Well, Sentinel-6 is really providing evidence. A satellite provides measurements all over the planet, and in the case of an altimeter, according to its orbit, and for us it's 66 north and 66 south in the reference orbit, extending this time series of sea level, sea surface heights, and the significant wave height, the top one third of the waves that you would measure in a time period, and the surface wind speed, and all of those together with other satellites give us the big picture. And it's that evidence base that's really important, because it's the same instrument that's been used all over the world to make those measurements. And so we're confident, using our ground verification and validation tools, that we've got really good measurements. And that gives trust, because trust is about making good decisions. The evidence from the Copernicus series of spacecraft are being used all the time by policymakers and decision makers at the European Commission, right the way down to local authorities that make use of this data in their day-to-day work. So I think that's really important to understand, that if you've got a tide gauge that's managed in the United Kingdom compared to tide gauges which are of a different design in Greece or in Italy or in Spain or in France or in Norway, those need to be intercalibrated. And the spacecraft can be one way to actually provide a consistent set of measurements to do that. I know it doesn't sound the right way to do it, but in fact, that's the way these things work. So global, consistent measurements, given us the evidence base to make good decisions with confidence. And we should remember that the evidence we use today, the decisions we make today, will impact us all as sea level continues to rise. So we need to get it right.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling home.
Yeah, I mean, good science is made by standing on the shoulders of giants. We need to have consensus from different views, from different groups, all working on the same problem. And so to make available data openly, transparently, with calibration information, with all the good data and the bad data not cleaned up, measurements as made, that's really at the core of making sure that we can have a really good scientific outcome. But it's not just science, it's also making sure that we have an engine and a compass there in the data that allows downstream users and services to build up their portfolio. And one of the things about Copernicus, which is so, so important, is that people can rely on it. It's been put there for the long term. We're not just building one spacecraft. In the Sentinel-6 case, we're building two, so that we can make sure we cover that duration of time that allows people to invest safely and securely in our future world. So those are all really, really important things. Open, transparent, accessible data. That's what Copernicus is about. Well, I think as people move to coastal megacities, we shouldn't underestimate the impacts, not just in developing island states, small island states like Maldives, where in that case you may see the entire relocation of the entire population. However, you know, it's not just there. It's people in New York. It's people in London. It's people in Amsterdam. It's people in Tokyo. There are many places around the world where there is a real threat. And we start to see those threats today. You can see, as Luca was mentioning earlier, some of the hurricanes and the impacts of the increase in sea level, together with the storm surges that comes with the large storms and the waves on top. The sea level we measure and the storm surge we can measure from Sentinel-6, as we can the waves. All of these conspire into extreme sea level events, which cause problems all over the low-lying coastlines of the world today. So it's a huge, huge issue that will only get worse given the commitment that we have to climate change and therefore the rise in sea level. Being prepared, that's the motto, be prepared. Just like the scouts and the guides, get ready for what's coming and make sure that in the local areas we have adequate protection and we understand how and why we can make sure we have a safer world for everybody.
That was Craig Donlan, the mission scientist on the Sentinel-6 spacecraft. He's not actually on the spacecraft. He works for the European Space Agency right here on Earth. And, it's part of our Planet Earth series.
This is Planet Earth. You're looking at Planet Earth. Bop, 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 bop. This is Planet Earth.
Early last year, NASA headquarters announced a new instrument to fly aboard the third joint polar satellite system in 2027. The instrument will be called Libera. The name pays homage to the instrument's heritage. In Roman mythology, Libera was the daughter of Ceres, the goddess of agriculture. For NASA, Libera will be the follow-on to the highly successful series of instruments called Ceres, C-E-R-E-S, was an acronym for Clouds and the Earth's Radiant Energy System. Libera will measure the top of the atmosphere's reflected solar radiation with wavelengths between 0.3 and 5 micrometers. It will also measure emitted radiation between 5 and 50 micrometers, as well as the combined reflected plus emitted radiation from 0.3 to 100 micrometers. The data collected will allow scientists to circulate the Earth's, or to calculate rather, the Earth's radiation budget. Well, we're going to hear now from the new NASA administrator, and he describes seeing the Earth from space and what it was like, because he has flown on the space shuttle.
And so, on the space shuttle, in between conducting 12 medical experiments, enjoying the best crew ever, whenever you would get a free moment, and that was rare, so often I had to cheat on my sleep. And I'd float up to the flight deck, and I'd just float there in front of the window, looking back at Earth. It really has an impression on you. And there's actually a term for it among space flyers. It's called the overview effect. Because in the window of your spacecraft, you see our home, the planet. And it looks so beautiful, such a creation in the middle of nothing. And yet, it also looks fragile. As a politician, I was struck by the fact that as we orbited the Earth every 90 minutes, I did not see political divisions. I did not see racial divisions. I did not see religious divisions. I saw that we were all in this together. And this is the unique mission of NASA, because we all come together as we push the frontier, as we push out into the unknown, and we see our planet, our home, and we have a central mission to protect our planet. As a result of that experience, I became more of an environmentalist because I could see our ecosystem. Bob Cabana is here. Anyone who has flown, or you see these dramatic photos and videos, and you look at the rim of the Earth, and you could actually see the thin film of the atmosphere, and you realize that that is what sustains all of life. With the naked eye, you could see from that altitude how we're messing it up. You could see the color contrast coming across Brazil in the upper Amazon region. You could look to the east. There's the mouth of the Amazon. You could see the silt for hundreds of miles out into the Atlantic. Coming across Madagascar back then, 36 years ago, they had cut down all the trees. And so when the rains came, there wasn't a topsoil. And all of that topsoil washed down the rivers. And you could clearly see that from space in the mouths of all the rivers, that silt flowing into the bright blue waters of the Indian Ocean. Because of that environmental effect, I was really excited last week to join the president in announcing a new development of a next generation of climate data systems at NASA. It's the Earth System Observatory to help us understand and track how climate change is impacting communities across the country and around the world. That meeting, held at FEMA headquarters in preparation for hurricane season, I underscored to the president how this Earth System Observatory will better help America and the world with better data to track natural hazards, including hurricanes, and be better prepared and to support our communities, families, and businesses before a disaster, not just after. The Earth System Observatory will consist of 5 integrated satellites, the first of which is scheduled to be launched in January of 23.
And that's Bill Nelson, the new administrator of NASA. Well, it's our time to leave.